It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at why so few people passed the GED last year after recent revisions to the test.
First, the State Department of Natural Resources will be taking a new look at the health and environmental effects, among other things, of one of Wisconsin's fastest growing industries, frac sand mining.
The announcement came yesterday after the group Midwest Environmental Advocates filed a petition with the DNR. The group asked them to conduct a strategic analysis of the industry, one that would study the economic and environmental impact, along with other issues related to quality of life.
Joining us now to tell us more about what the DNR will be looking at is Kimberly Wright. She's the executive director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Kimberly, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
So why was it important for the DNR to take a closer look at the state's frac sand industry?
Well, as you said, it's a fast-growing industry. It's literally a landscape-scale transformation of communities, and there's been really no study of cumulative impacts. So, for instance, in Trempealeau County, that's where the highest concentration of frac sand mines is. And as there's been permitting decisions made, they're made looking at one facility as if it exists on its own with, and, you know, just the, there's so many issues and such a high concentration of industrial activity. It's very, very important to look at the impacts.
So the DNR is going to conduct this strategic analysis, and that's a thing with a particular meaning as defined by the state. What does a strategic analysis mean?
Well, what's important about the strategic analysis is that it ensures citizens' rights to participate, and it's the scope of this analysis is broad. So you might think of it as an analogous to an environmental impact statement, where the not just one small issue is looked at, but a broad range of issues and impacts. So when we compiled the petition, we worked with citizens and community leaders to see what the problems, are. What are problems in everybody's daily lives? So there's a long list, 29 pages of issues, and they're from local problems local businesses have to people's concerns about very serious public health issues, endangered resources, loss of farmland. I mean, it's a very broad set of issues. And one reason we worked with citizens on that petition is because this is such an all-encompassing industry in the areas where it's concentrated, it's hard to just sit and list off all of those things. So we wanted to get those all in one place to define, part of the scope of the problem, put that before the DNR, and we are so pleased at the quick response of the Natural Resources Board, and that they're setting a timeline of 365 days to finish this analysis, and we're very pleased at that.
Now, is the goal here to put a stop to some or all frac sand mining? Are we kind of fishing for hurdles and roadblocks to throw in front of the industry with this report?
No, not at all. This is it's not decision making at all. This is gathering information to inform decision makers. So, as you know, there's been a lot of decision making at the local level, and that's where citizens have had some level of say about, how their community looks and how, what's going on in their community. So, there's just so many people making decisions. It is the DNR's role as our state science agency to look at these issues and gather the information that's already available, look for gaps, and fill those gaps in information. So, no, this report is gathering credible information and sound science so that decisions can be made.
So you've been in touch with people who live in areas affected by, live near frac sand mines. What kind of personal stories have you been hearing from people?
Oh, boy. Stories like one woman who has small children lives on a corner of a truck route. And I don't know if you've seen these. They're very, very, very large semi-trailers, sometimes they're double length and very heavy because they're filled with sand, and they're timed to go about every 30 seconds because the timing relates to how fast they can dump their load at the other end of the line. So this woman lives on a corner by a stop sign, so all day long, 24 hours a day, she hears, you know, and then vroom, and it's very hard on her family. You know, that's their life, is to hear that all the time. At one public hearing, I talked to an older man who's a light sleeper, and he was, you know, in tears. He said, "I've tried everything. I can't sleep. The noise is just too much for me." So he lives in his basement. And there, you know, there's just so many stories like that. I mean, there's very serious public health issues, very serious environmental issues with water and air, but why citizens' voices matter so much in the scoping process are all of those stories. You know, if you don't live in the midst of this industry, you don't know, you just don't know. And I learn something new every time I go out and talk to people.
Have you looked at lessons from other states? Wisconsin is a leader, maybe the leader in frac sand, but other states have it. Are there things that you think other states are doing that we might copy here?
Yeah, Minnesota has done certainly a much better job at having some community dialogue and looking at particular issues. And I think the DNR is intending to look at states that have science and standards that are would work in the frac sand industry. California, Texas, and Vermont have silica standards. It is a hazardous air pollutant, and it's regulated in the workplace, but there is no standard in somebody's home. So, you know, there are those standards based on sound science in other states. So that'll be some of the information available to the DNR to bring in to our quiver of information.
Now that the DNR board has decided to do this strategic analysis of the impact of frac sand, what's the timeline?
Well, the public input during the scoping process, deciding, you know, what needs to be studied, the DNR would like to finish that up by March. And then they are saying 1 year, 365 days, and there'll be another public input period after the draft analysis is prepared. Then the public will have another chance to look at that and make comments. So you know, that's the importance of the department, you know, using the Wisconsin Environmental Protection Act, you know, to ensure that citizens have a say in something that, you know, deeply impacts their lives.
So once this report is done, can the DNR set rules based on it, or would it have to go to the legislature to change anything?
Well, you know, the process of making rules was changed in Wisconsin, which is, you know, not really on the side of citizens. So the governor now has veto power, basically, over rulemaking. It's been very time-consuming. We're very concerned about some Clean Water Act-related rules that are, you know, insufficient and need to be changed. And the department sometimes says that you know, it takes them 5 years to make a rule. So, you know, there's a lot of public policy issues that hopefully the citizens and communities can talk about. You know, we need our government to work for us.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Kimberly Wright. She's the executive director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, talking about some new action from the state DNR, kicking off a strategic analysis of frac sand and its impacts here in the state.
First, the GED, or High School Equivalency Diploma Test, was revamped for the first time since 2002 last year. Part of the argument for the change was that the exam didn't actually test people's knowledge of what they would otherwise learn in high school.
Last year, the exam was computerized and brought in line with Common Core standards. Since the change, the number of people who passed the exam plummeted from over 540,000 in 2013 to about 86,000 in 2014.
The 2013 numbers may be somewhat inflated because of the rush to take the exam before it was changed, but many are saying that the rigor and cost of the new GED have also played a big role in that draw.
In fact, one writer for the Daily Beast, an Ivy League grad with a high school degree, a bachelor's, and a master's, set out to take the exam only to flunk it.
Here with us now is Anna Zambi. She's an administrative manager at the Madison Area Technical College School of Academic Advancement and coordinator of the GED changeover. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how exactly was the GED changed in this most recent swing through it?
I think the biggest changes were that we went from a paper-based exam to a computer-based exam. I think that was definitely the biggest step. The second was in cost. The cost did go up. A lot of that cost was passed on down to the student. And then, of course, the content of the test changed. And it's testing students in a different manner, more analytical stuff or critical thinking instead of maybe just random facts or memorization.
So you said the content has changed to make it more analytical, critical thinking. In terms of how a student prepares for the test, what does that mean?
What we're finding in the classroom is that the strategies for passing the test are a little bit different because we're teaching things a little bit different. But we're finding that you're going to have to spend a little bit more time in the classroom, more consistency. Kind of the attendance behaviors have to change in order to really master the material in order to pass the test. Whereas before, maybe it was, come on in, we'll be flexible, you know, life happens, other things can happen, we'll work with you. Now it's a little bit more streamlined, a little bit more tough.
You mentioned a trio of changes there. What was the case for making those changes last year?
The test was brought into the 21st century, so it meant requiring a computer to take the test. You now have to pay exclusively with a credit card. And also, we've adapted the content of the test to kind of reflect the Common Core standards, which are being used throughout high schools. And that is where we've talked about, you know, kind of developing that critical thinking, that problem solving or analytical skills that students would need to be successful in college or in the workforce.
So is it fair to say, just across the board, that this exam is tougher, it's harder than the previous one?
I believe so.
And what about, you know, why people take a test like this? Does it serve the people who take the test that it is harder, that they have to have mastery maybe over more things than they may have had to before?
And that leads me to the question of who is the GED test for and what should it measure? Historically, the test has always been the gateway towards employment, exclusively or possibly into a college track. The test has always struggled with meeting those two groups, and I'll say that this test, the new test, the 2014 test on the computer, is further away from straddling that divide. I think that the new test is very much geared towards preparing students for college, not necessarily the skills that one might need in the workforce. Not to say that the test is not appropriate for students who would want to enter the workforce. Computer literacy skills, analytical skills, all of those are great anywhere, you know, and applicable in life. However, the test is very academic now, and I think that tends to scare away a certain population, and I think that the computer technology needs, you know, the access to computers, the necessity to pay with a credit card, all of that kind of excludes a certain group of people that might actually benefit the most from receiving a GED certificate.
In terms of this drop in people who have been taking the exam, what do you put it down to?
Twofold. Number one is we love deadlines. Once you put a deadline on that, December 2013, everybody's going to scramble to finish whatever they started. So there was a tremendous push to finish everybody before the changeover deadline. So we saw record numbers of students in our classrooms, in the classrooms of community-based organizations, and passing the test. So, of course, the following year, we're not going to see that many students because most of them did finish already. The second biggest reason, I think, is that we used the rigor of the tests changing and also the cost of the test rising as kind of that push to get people to finish. And I think that that is still staying with us, is that the test is harder and it costs more. So people aren't as willing to walk in the door and try this as maybe we'll see in the next couple years.
You say the test has been modernized. Part of the effect, it sounds like, is that it is harder. It has a cost. It's on a computer or has a bigger price tag. At the end of the day, though, don't we want people to get their high school degrees, their GEDs, and if fewer people are taking this, is there something that's not working about it?
Historically, we always see a drop in test takers when the test changes over. Typically, it changes over every 10 years. This one was a 12-year period. So I think that the low numbers are typical of what you would see when the GED tests change. I think they will go up. And I agree, it's not bad to challenge, you know, us as a community to reach other goals. The test is following that. You know, it's challenging us in different ways. I think we'll get on board and we'll learn how to deal with the test and take care of it in other ways.
You mentioned computers. So in terms of accessibility, reaching the broadest group of people, is that a barrier for some people that it has to be done on a computer?
It is. I think that the test data that you'll see now, the type of passer that's passing these tests probably have a computer in their home. They probably have some sort of computer literacy level that's pretty high. These are timed tests, and if you are not familiar with the computer, that might affect your ability to pass the test. I think if you don't have a credit card, if you don't have money in the bank and a credit card, suddenly this is now a new barrier for you. And that shouldn't happen. You know, the high school completion should be accessible to everybody. And so we have significant challenges in how we meet those, making sure that everybody who is entitled to a high school diploma or needs a second chance, like a GED, is able to achieve that.
So there are things in place, and if someone doesn't have a computer at home, might not have those computer literacy skills, what do you recommend they do so they get up to speed, so when they go in there to take that test, that they're not hung up on something like they can't get their mouse to move around the screen or something?
You know, we at the Technical College and a lot of the community-based organizations around town definitely have opportunities. We have computer basics classes. We have GED classes. We have basic skills classes. We can provide access to computers. We can provide instruction in math and language arts and science and social studies, everything that you need. It might not happen overnight, but it will happen. And I think that's the message that I'd like to get out. Is that it is achievable. We will make sure that it is achievable. But we'll have a few hurdles along the way, specifically the credit cards. I think, you know, you have to go and buy a burner card, put money onto a credit card, and then take it in and register on a computer. If you don't have a credit card or a computer at home, you're going to need some help. You're going to need the community to step up to help you out.
Do you get people calling you saying, yeah, I want to take this, but I don't have a credit card?
We address that at some of our orientations with options. If you don't have a credit card, you know, you can, and have cash, we can get you a burner card, you know, a prepaid credit card to use. Or there might be some scholarships available. There's certain grants that pay for the GED test for certain folks. So there's options, and we know about them, and we connect everybody to the right option.
So it's just a matter of navigating your way through these things.
That yeah.
There are options. There are workaround solutions, but sometimes you have to look for them or find them.
You do. You have to walk in the door and ask.
Now, in terms of why people take the GED, what kind of goals do people have? Why do most people take it?
I think our experience at the Technical College shows that a majority, and I'm saying probably over 70%, have the goal of obtaining employment or maintaining employment. Perhaps they need it to get a job. They're unemployed. They need it to keep a job. And I would say that 30% might have that intent of going into college. Not to say that the folks who want immediate employment aren't interested in furthering their you know, technical trainings or whatever. It just might not be that semester or that next academic year, but they might come back to the college later on.
So only 30% want to go on to college?
Immediately.
Right
only
now.
30% mm-hmm. want to get a GED in order to go into college.
Right. So the 70% wants to keep a job, hold a job, maybe go on to college.
And then probably will be employed, come back out, come back to the college for further training in their career track. It's we they don't come back right away, but they do come back.
And in terms of who's taking this test, is there a typical profile of the person who takes a GED?
We see folks of all ages, all races, coming through to complete high school.
Now, several other states have stopped offering the GED. They're opting for other, newer exams. What do you think about that? Should that be something Wisconsin is looking at?
That could be something that Wisconsin could look at. Wisconsin is unique in that it offers GED testing as well as other high school completion options. But I like the ability to choose, and I like that there's more options out there, and that competitive nature between those three tests, the TASC and the HiSET and the GED, to make things a little bit more competitive.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us and talking about the GED today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Anna Zambi about changes to the GED made last year. She's an administrative manager at Madison Area Technical College School of Academic Achievement and coordinator of the GED changeover. As we gather around to watch the Super Bowl this weekend, all eyes will be on the players and their on-field performances. For NFL players, glamour and glory are the norm. That is until the playing days come to an end, and that's where some of the serious problems can sometimes begin.
It's not just the long-term health effects associated with playing the game, which have been in the spotlight lately, but stories of financial disaster, debilitating mental health problems, drug addiction, even suicide seem to be all too common. Our next guest wanted answers to some pretty serious questions. Why do so many NFL players go on to live horror stories? And what, if anything, can be done to help players once they hang up the cleats and assist them with the transition into the next phase of their lives?
We're joined now by Jim Holstein, still trying to get a hold of George Kuntz Jr. James is a professor of sociology at Marquette University, and he's co-author of the book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. Jim, welcome to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Veronica.
Well, when we talk about what it's like to be in the NFL, it's something that, you know, probably about 99.9% of us are never going to experience. And you write about it in terms of being in the bubble. What is it like inside the NFL bubble?
Well, we know something about being in the bubble, but for players in the NFL, remember, they're elite athletes who have been striving for this and been participating in elite athletics for 15 years before they got there. It starts when they're before high school, moving into high school through college. Their lives revolve around the game, and they're kind of insulated from the rest of the world, treated special because of their special talents. And due to this, they sort of become encapsulated. So at the end of the day, at the end of the career, when the football days are over, they're sort of outside, and they haven't been outside this bubble in their adult lives. And that's kind of the root for many of the problems that they encounter.
Well, in terms of things like cultivating a family life, honing social skills, relationships, maintaining a job that you go to every day. Are those skills that the players come out deficient in, or is it something that it's not too hard to play catch-up on?
I'm reluctant to use the word deficient because I don't want to speak about all players in that sense. But what we do find is that here are men who, if they've spent considerable time in the National Football League, they'll maybe be in their early 30s, but they haven't been out in the world fending for themselves any more than, say, most 18, 19, 20-year-olds have. And given that, yes, there are some skills that they haven't honed as well. If you asked any 18-year-old, how do you balance a checkbook? What do you do to get an apartment and set up your own living situation? Kids can probably turn to their parents, and they will for a few years, and that's what growing up is all about. Well, for guys in the NFL, part of the thing has been for the time that they're in the NFL, people have been helping with that too, and they haven't fully grasped the responsibility. The family things are difficult too. Many of the players are more likely to be married than their age peers in the general population. But their families also get a little isolated, and frankly, their families also help isolate them because families, wives especially, take over running their lives for them while they put everything in to the game. They're spending Packers up at Lambeau Field during the season. They're showing up at the practice facility before 7 o'clock, and they may not come home till after 6. That's not much of a life outside the bubble.
We've got George Kuntz Jr. with us on the line now. He is the Vice President of Advancement at Marion University. You may best remember him from his playing days as a linebacker for the Green Bay Packers. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's bring you in on this, George. Can you share a little bit of your own story? What happened after you realized that your pro football days were over and the roller coaster that came afterwards?
Oh, most definitely. I know Dr. Holstein was just talking about the bubble, and I'm down in Phoenix. I'm over in Phoenix, Arizona right now for some of the Super Bowl activities, and I have about 10 people with me, and they have a special place for former football players to bring their families, to bring colleagues, to really work on the cultivation. And some of my colleagues were just saying, George, I read your book, and it is part of the bubble because it's an exclusive area. Drinks, food, everything is free. It's in one of the most one of the nicest restaurants in Phoenix, and so a lot of players get kind of used to this type of living, being catered to. So I was no different when I was playing in the National Football League. I kind of got on the conveyor belt when I was about 9 years old, and I was very fortunate to play until I was 32. But when I left out of the National Football League, or when the bubble burst, the little mundane things that a lot of people can handle at ease, I struggle with them.
What were some of those challenges that hit you hardest when you realized that your football days were over?
Well, just to assimilate into, you know, everyday life. I didn't really know how to manage my finances. I thought I did, but I had a lot of resources and a support system around me while I was in the National Football League. I had financial advisors, I had agents, and things like that. But when football left me, my support system kind of left as well. And I was kind of out there on an island. I was kind of isolated. And that's when the depression set in, and I struggled for about 2 years.
And what happened at the end of those 2 years? How did you rebuild your life and focus in on who you were going to become today?
Well, my wife, you know, we had a come to Jesus moment when I got into a car wreck, and she said, George, you know, we can't reinvent who you are. We just have to redefine, because your purpose in life isn't to run around on the football field with a helmet on trying to hit someone. I think your purpose is really trying to give back, trying to make a community, trying to make your community a better place in which you found it. So I made it up in my mind at that time, you know, I have to go back to school. I have to get some education. I have to be educated, because I had a college degree, but I wasn't really necessarily educated. And I was able to, you know, go back to school and get going and try to make a difference in this world, try to make a difference in those communities in which I came from.
And Jim, you know, I think for everybody, making a transition from one phase of life to the next can be something that's troubling. It can be a rocky period of life. But it seems like in the NFL, some of those problems get amplified. Why do you think that is?
Oh, you're absolutely right that everyone goes through transitions, and the transitions are difficult. And I don't want to suggest, now we're not suggesting here that NFL players are victims of some terrible circumstance where they have riches thrust upon them and glory and fame, and then they have to go cold turkey. But there is a sense in which they're so tightly woven into this community, this locker room, the camaraderie of that. If you want to look at people who have similar sorts of transition problems, you might take a look at retiring police officers, firefighters, people coming out of the military. Because there you find a similar situation where they spend a good portion of their lives working together, socializing together, playing together, and their lives are structured around that one central activity. And when that comes to an end, that's just a little bit different than those of us who have more mundane jobs. When that ends, we're not going cold turkey in the same sense. that people in those highly institutionalized jobs are. And the NFL, I don't want to suggest that there are too many parallels with, say, the police or the military, but many of the problems are the same ones you'd see.
Well, we're talking right now with George Kuntz and James Holstein. They're the authors of the new book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. And you may remember George from his days with the Green Bay Packers. They wanted to get to the bottom of why the lives of NFL players can be difficult post-football and what needs to happen to smooth that transition.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. We're talking with sociologist James Holstein and former Green Bay Packer linebacker George Kuntz. They're authors of the new book, Is There Life After Football?, which explores why many former pro football players go wrong in retirement and what, if anything, can be done to change that.
And I want to talk a little bit about something that's been in the news a lot lately, especially this last year or two, and that's injuries, especially brain injuries for players, current and former players. George, now that there's more awareness of concussions and brain injuries than ever before, is this still a key problem that needs addressing to help these players go on to lead productive and healthy lives?
Oh, most definitely. I often read the history about the different injuries that we've sustained over the years. And I think back over the 90s when I played, when I first came to the National Football League, there was a few players that became paralyzed, like Dennis Byrd, who played for the New York Jets, and Mike Utley, who played for Detroit Lions. And then the NFL implemented some different rules and the way you can block. And we haven't really heard about players becoming paralyzed as of late. And then in the 2000s, you heard about a guy by the name of Corey Stringer and dehydration. So the NFL stepped in and made some things illegal for supplements that players can take, and now we're talking about the concussion, and I think the NFL is going to step in and really change the way the game is played. It's going to look totally different, but I think it's going to be a game that's going to be still recognizable to all the football faithful around this great nation, because football is a great game, but we got to make sure we keep it safe for the players, and because we have about 8 million youth that are playing football around our great nation. And we just want to make sure that they're safe and they're able to play without any harm, long-term effects.
Do you think that the risk at this point is worth it, both for young people who might be starting the sport early like you did, teens and younger than that, and the potential payoff, which is a big payoff, but do you think at this point it's worth it? Have we really cracked the code on how to keep players safe at this point, George?
Yes, I think so. I think that when I look back, I started playing football when I was 9 years old. And if I had to do it all over again, I was very fortunate to play from 9 years old to 32. If I had to do it all over again, I would do it because I think the positives outweigh the negatives. And I think that there are some instances, such as one of my former teammates, a guy by the name of Jim McMahon, who's dealing with dementia right now. But I think there's not a lot of those stories. I think there's a lot of good stories out there, but we're not hearing about them.
And Jim, let's talk a little more about the financial aspect of this. There's an incredible statistic that you cite in your book. According to Sports Illustrated, over three-quarters of former NFL players are in desperate financial straits within 2 years of retirement. Now, football, we think of this as, being a pretty high-paying job, maybe not quite as much as professional baseball players who don't have the salary cap, but how is it possible that someone could make millions of dollars and still be struggling with cash flow 2 years after the NFL?
Well, I'll get to that, but let me go to that statement about that. We do cite that statement from Sports Illustrated, but we make the point that there's absolutely no corroboration of that. That if you look high and low, you can't find where that figure, that number comes from. There are a lot of players, and they come out of the NFL and they get high-profile stories about them squandering their fortunes. And I don't want to deny that. But if you look systematically at the former players across the board, an awful lot of them are doing just fine. And so it's a myth there that guys come out of the league, squander fortunes, and then are flat broke when they're done. Now, having said that, your question was, how can they make so much money and still have financial troubles? Well, as you suggested, first of all, they don't make as much money as most of us think. All the major sports leagues, the NFL is the lowest paid. Well, we hear that the average salary is somewhere around $2 million a year this year. That's a figure that's inflated and brought way up by the high price of mostly quarterbacks, and that the median salary, the middle point in the salary range for NFL players is somewhere closer to $700,000. Half the players in the league are making less than that. Again, that's good money, but it doesn't last that long. And so if the average career is 3.5 years, most guys are making better than the guys they went to school with, to college with, to high school with. But it doesn't last that long, and they're not set for life. And so when they come out of the league, when they are, as we put it in the book, too, when they are fired from their jobs, because most NFL players do not leave their careers voluntarily. They either leave due to injury or leave because their teams cut them. And when they leave the league, they're not sitting on a huge pile of cash. And so they have to pick up and get themselves going. Now, I'm not making excuses for those of them who fail, but they do, as George just said. They have to pick themselves up and get started down another path. They can take advantage of the great things that have happened to them, but, you know, they still have to make something of themselves and can't rest on their laurels and on the paychecks that are no longer coming in.
And, George, about 30 seconds left to go, but quickly, what would you like to tell football players about how to succeed at life after the NFL?
Well, for one, I just think that they have to have other interests outside of football, because when I was playing football back in the 90s, I was working with my father in construction, and I had basically two careers going at the same time on two parallel tracks. It was hard, but I did it, and the current players that are in the National Football League, one thing about them, they're smart, they're disciplined, they know how to manage their time.
And we have to leave it there. George, thank you so much for that final word of advice there. Keep up your interest. George and James, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with George Kuntz and James Holstein. They're co-authors of Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL.